Welcome to Outdoor Explore. I'm your host, Paul Twardoff. Many Alaskans have helped preserve the open spaces we enjoy. This Outdoor Explorer features Peg Tileston. Peg has been active in organizations including the Alaska Center, formerly the Alaska Center for the Environment, the Alaska Women's Environmental Network, the Alaska Conservation Foundation, Trustees for Alaska, and Alaska Common Ground. She has also been on Anchorage's Parks and Recreation Council and the Anchorage Recycling Task Force. Along the way, she explored much of Alaska. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explore. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardoff. I'm here with Peg Tileston. Welcome to the show, Peg.
Good to be here, Paul. It's good to see you again.
Yeah. Peg, boy, what a life you've lived and are continuing to live. And you've contributed so much to Alaska and South Central and everything that we enjoy. It's hard to decide where to start. But let's start with your growing up and your childhood and sort of how that path came to Alaska and being a conservationist you are.
I grew up in Indiana on a large farm that my uncle owned, and I had a Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn kind of beginning. We didn't have any responsibilities to the farm, so spent a lot of time climbing trees and enjoying growing up in a very rural situation. Excuse me. And went to a liberal arts college in Indiana and was teaching there for a while. I taught in Maryland when we moved there. Intended to teach when I came up to Alaska. We came up in 1972. My husband was with the Department of Interior and did the Wild and Scenic River Studies here that ultimately wound up in the legislative package in Congress. And I intended to teach when I came up, but the school district wasn't interested in talking to anybody until they had 5 hours of something in the last 5 years. And so I went to UAA and took 6 hours, actually 1 hour of cross-country skiing. And but by the time I had finished that, I found out enough about the school district at that time that I really wasn't interested. Ran into some folks that said, hey, the Alaska Center for the Environment needs some volunteer help. And that sort of set me on the track of where I am today.
Let's go back to your childhood. Was there anything in there that you can look back, or even college, and were like, that was the seed of being a conservationist?
Well, I think growing up on a farm really, really set that in motion. You have a sense of the importance of how things grow and how things are put together in a rural situation or on a farm that is unique.
Yeah. And I imagine it also is you end up learning how to solve problems.
And a lot of self-determination in terms of how you address problems. If you don't do it, then it doesn't get done sometimes.
Right. You moved to Alaska in 1972, that right?
Mm-hmm.
And was that following your husband? Like what was the motivation there?
My husband was with the Department of Interior.
Uh-huh.
At that time, it was the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation. And he did the Wild and Scenic Rivers. He and brought Pat Prochot up as part of the team.
Uh-huh.
And they ran rivers. And I actually got up on the Evershack and ran it in a canoe. And we have obviously done a lot of boating ever since, both in canoes and bigger boats.
Yeah.
And thoroughly enjoyed Alaska's outdoors as much as a lot of other people who do.
And I think does that also lead to this idea, like you're out enjoying the Alaska outdoors, your motivation to, I mean, you've been at this forever, it seems like, this conservation. So there's a lot of, what keeps that drive going?
Probably just the understanding the importance of organizations. I spend probably more time in the organization part of it. As I said, I started with the Alaska Center for the Environment, did a number of years as a volunteer and on the board, and then ultimately as an executive director for a while. And have been involved in organizing other organizations, such as the Alaska Conservation Foundation, the Trustees for Alaska, and I'm still on the Board of Trustees for Alaska. And more recently, with Esther Wernicke, starting the Alaska Alaska Common Ground, which is a public policy organization.
Yeah. So when you moved up here in 1970, that's a time of huge change for Alaska.
Enormous.
When you look back on that time period, reflect on that a little bit and what was going on. And you said you got involved with Alaska Center for the Environment and I think Alaska National Interest Lands Claims Act or a Conservation Act was going on, Alaska Lands Act. And so talk to us about that, what was going on, what your sort of memories and what was happening with that.
When we came up, the pipeline, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was still, the act had just been passed in Congress to make sure that it went forward. Up until that time, Alaska was still wondering if the pipeline was going to get built. The pipe was, of course, stacked in the on the areas around the ports, both Anchorage and Valdez, and it was still questionable whether or not the pipeline was going to be built. The ANILCA, I'm sorry, the national ANSCA had just been passed
Native
in
Settlement
1970,
Claims Act.
Right, the Claims Act had just been passed. And so there were all sorts of bumper stickers around on cars at that time. Let the bastards freeze in the dark, and Sierra Club go home, and all sorts of ideas around points of view being put on cars at the time. Anyway, in the 1970s, early 70s, the pipeline, of course, started to be built. And the influx of people from outside was an incredible change in Alaska's attitudes, population. People were being inundated with all sorts of problems. Fairbanks was really impacted very badly. Anchorage had its own problems. And during that build-up to the pipeline and while the pipeline was being built, Alaska changed dramatically and has changed since then. People sometimes wonder what Alaska would have been like without the pipeline. It certainly would have been different than it is today. And during that time, of course, the Alaska Center for the Environment was all volunteer, continued to be all volunteer until the late 70s when we finally got staff. But at that time, it was interesting that a lot of outside media would come to the center or would call the center and ask for information about what was happening in Alaska. Both from the West Coast, primarily West Coast, but also from the East Coast, so that contact information was very important to get information out. And also during that time, at the end of the 70s, it was realized that it was important that Alaska conservation organizations be areas would be added to in terms of having both the legal a legal arm and a foundation arm. And so the Alaska Conservation Foundation was formed, the Trustees for Alaska was formed, And at that time, we had an organization which was the Alaska Conservation Assembly, which actually brought people from all over the state together to deal with, or to talk about and plan for how we could respond to what was happening in the state, which was major changes.
It's hard to really imagine an Alaska without oil and the pipeline, but that in itself was controversial.
Absolutely. Building
the pipeline. And then obviously the Alaska Lands Act, signed by Jimmy Carter in 1980, was super controversial.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Very, very controversial. And it was one of the most controversial part of it was the subsistence part of the ANILCA, Alaska Lands Act, because the Alaska Fish and Game people were very much opposed to the subsistence section, and it was very important to the Alaska conservation movement that section stay in the act. And in fact, the Alaska conservation movement was opposed by the national organizations because they didn't want it either, because it opened the part of the Alaska lands to subsistence hunting, and that was not what the nationals wanted.
That's interesting to think that the dichotomy between the national groups and the local groups. Because I think a lot of times they're clumped in all together
right.
in one basket,
yes,
but that's
right.
not
and
necessarily
the case. Definitely not the same.
Yeah.
Even today, the nationals and the local organizations do not always agree with each other.
Yeah. So we had that period. Let's talk about the Alaska Center for the Environment. You and I were on the board for a long time together, and it seemed like you were on that board forever.
It was a long time.
Right. And I know you mentioned earlier that you were primarily involved in organizational aspects, starting these organizations mm-hmm. and growing them, and that's incredibly important. What were some of the challenges with that?
Primarily, actually, there's always been a very large contingent of people in Alaska who are concerned about the environment and the conservation of the area. Alaska, we got one of the things that we got organized around was the BLM tract, which was at that time not organized in a conservation movement. And so Walt Parker and a number of other people were very instrumental in getting it identified as a conservation area, and so now we have the Camel Track. And the Science Center out there as a major part of our community, which is wonderful. But again, these kind of things don't happen overnight, and it takes one or two people to actually act as a fulcrum to get things like that happening. But it's amazing how one or two people with a bright idea can really make things happen.
And so much happened in the 70s with a few people that now we take for granted. For instance, Tugat State Park.
Absolutely.
The trail systems in
right.
town, and that's all, it's always been, especially the Tugat State Park and Campbell Track have always amazed me that those sit by the city. That wasn't necessarily a given.
No.
Right?
Absolutely not. And the trail system of Lainey Fleischer ate more yep. rubber chicken than anybody should have to, because she would go to all the organization meetings at noon and talk about a bike trail, the bike day, and getting a bike trails organized. And afterward, one or two people would come up and say, hey, that's a great idea. And the bike day occurred with people riding their bikes down 9th Avenue And out of that came the trail system.
The bike did. What was that? I never heard about that.
It was a day dedicated to people getting on their bikes and riding down 9th Avenue and having a big show of support for bike trails in Alaska.
Oh, fun. Yeah, and fun, too.
Yeah.
That now we have Bike to Work Day.
Yes, yes.
So sort of
and a wonderful set of trails.
Yeah.
And as I said, it was one person, Lainey Fleischer, who got it all organized and started.
Yep. So also, I think you mentioned recycling, one of the issues that you're...
The Center for the Environment had a little gray house that was on the corner, or almost on the corner of 6th Avenue and I Street. And we had a porch that was always open, and people could bring not only their newspapers, but also their aluminum cans and drop them off there. And the papers went to Thermacool, which I think is still in business and making... insulation and the stuff that they spray on the roadsides with fertilizer and grass seeds. And I think they're out in the valley now, but they took all of our newspapers, and people could drop off newspapers on the porch. And then probably in the early 80s, the city that had been doing some recycling shut it down, and we had a big recycling conference and got it started again. And the recycling's been going on ever since.
That's amazing. Just a thing that is so common sense as that it's been such a fight to keep tackling. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torda. I'm sitting here with Peg Tileston in the studio today. Peg's been a conservationist and activist in Alaska since the early 70s. Peg, moving on from recycling, you mentioned some other organizations you've been involved with and getting involved with or starting, and including Alaska Conservation Foundation. Talk about what they do and why that was important.
The foundation was started primarily with the idea that it was important to be able to get funds into Alaska from other foundations and other support. And it has been a major conduit for money going to other organizations in the state. It still is very active and still very involved in Alaska conservation issues. And certainly, money is always important and always difficult for Alaska organizations to have in order to operate. And so the foundation has been a very important role in helping keep the organizations going.
Yeah, I bring that up because I think it's interesting that these things that we sort of take for granted now, whether it's Tugat State Park or trails or the Campbell Track, have been fights. And and many times not that one side or another, are disagreements of how things were to be. And many times the resources were significantly weighted toward the development side.
Absolutely.
And because they rightly so have a lot invested, and they have a lot to gain from whether it's developing a piece of land or whatever, so that public interest and really the interest of the natural world, no one really pays for that, where development does pay.
Absolutely.
Right. And so I think that's important.
And yet, people really do care about what's going on in their backyard, whether it's a stream that is getting polluted or whether it's an area that... And in fact, one of the reasons that the environmental movement actually got started nationally was that people saw things happening in areas that they like to recreate in, and they said, hey, we're not going to take it anymore, and got started getting organized. And interestingly enough, the National Interest, Environmental Protection Act came out of actually the interstate highway being built. And normally they first started going through areas that were the low-income areas, and they would knock on people's doors and say, you're out of here in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month.
Wow.
And with no public process involved at all. And that happened for 2 or 3 years. And finally, I believe it was in Massachusetts, they started going, knocking on doors of more affluent neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, hey, wait a minute here. This is going to stop. And ultimately, out of that came the Environmental Protection Act. And up until that time, people were saying, hey, I'm concerned about what's happening in my neighborhood, and not getting organized and realizing that in order to make a difference, they were going to have to get organized. And people did, and the various changes in legal areas came about. A lot of money was attached to the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and organizations began to take advantage of those monies and become much more staffed and organized and effective in responding to challenges.
Yeah. And it does seem like a lot of that is local.
Always local.
Sometimes we get focused on panda bears or, you know, exotic things, but boy, when it comes locally, it really hits home.
That's right.
Yep.
People really realize what they could lose in their own neighborhood, and it is a very forceful way for people to get involved.
We sort of talked about the 70s some. Moving into the 80s, what were some of the changes and challenges during that time?
The passage of the Native Claims Settlement Act had the D2 section. And in fact, every once in a while I talk about D2, and people new to Alaska look at me and say, what are you talking about? Well, D2 is the section of the Alaska Native Claims Act which said that was passed that said that 80 million acres would be set aside for conservation units, park service, parks, refuges, and forests primarily. And so the D2 section became a rallying cry for Alaskans, and the Alaska Coalition actually started in Alaska, although it became a national movement, to encourage the passage of what became a NILCA, the National Claims Settlement Act. I have to think about what it all stands for. That was signed by President Carter in 1980, which set aside 104 million acres of lands, which also included wild and scenic rivers, which is what we came up to work on originally. So it was, and the passage of an ILCA, although there were many people in Alaska who fought very hard against it, many also wound up feeling that it was a very important change for Alaska and has protected lands that needed to be protected.
Yeah, it was fought so hard, but in the consequence, we got Kenai Fjords National Park,
yes.
We got expanded Denali. We got a lot of things that now are really economic engines.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And fear of locking up has not necessarily been as bad as a lot of people thought.
Let's face it, the ultimate lockup is private land.
So I guess going forward into the 80s, so we have a lot of land going back and forth. We still do in Alaska,
yes,
right?
Yes,
there are still things happening with that. What other sort of significant things were going on in the 80s that, from a conservationist standpoint? And I'm thinking like logging and all kinds of stuff.
Right, yeah. And the transfer of land, both for native and for private use, has made some difference in terms of land use in Alaska. One of the concerns, obviously, that continues to be a problem is wildlife management in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Our state organization, the Alaska Fish and Game Agency, still wants to go after bears with bear baiting and getting cubs in the den and killing them, and the problem with predator control, which we spend a lot of money on and don't really make much difference on, but we do spend the Fish and Game spends a lot of money on predator control. So there are problems in terms of some of the way our agencies react.
Interesting predator control, because it's been on in the news this last couple of weeks, because Board of Game met and addressed things in the Anchorage Bowl in the South Central Alaska,
right.
Including some expanded bear hunts and moose hunts. And some people are supportive of that, and then obviously other people aren't. And in your opinion, and we're coming up to our break, but here pretty soon. But I want to talk about Alaska Common Ground, in a minute. But how in that particular issue, like how do we move forward with that? Like how do we make progress in things where people have so many opinions, such as Fish and Game Management.
Yeah. It's difficult coming out of the pandemic that we've been in which so many people have been unable to get together and talk with each other. I think that problems can be solved if people are willing to sit down and talk about them. And You don't have to agree with everybody, and in fact, it's good not to agree with everybody. But if people can talk together and find solutions about problems, usually you can come up with some good answers. And hopefully, now that we're coming out of the pandemic arena that we've been in, we can get more public discourse happening.
Great. That brings us to the end of our first half. Thanks, Peg. We'll be right back. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. And I'm your host, Paul Tortoff. We'll be right back after a short break with more with Peg Tyleston.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm here with Peg Tyleston going over her rich history with Alaska and conservation movement up here. Let's talk about people a bit. And you've probably met a ton of people, probably every governor, right?
Yes.
And how's that different in Alaska than elsewhere?
Well, the pressure points in Alaska are still very close to the surface. when we lived in Maryland, if you wanted to get in touch with a decision maker, you kind of had to know somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody to get you even anybody to answer the phone. In Alaska, if you wanted to talk to a decision maker, and even yet, you pick up the phone and you usually can get through to them, certainly to the legislators and even to the governor or the mayor. You can get through to and have a conversation. And that is so unusual for the rest of the country. It is unique for Alaska, and people really need to take advantage of it. I've always heard that if a legislator gets 10 or 15 letters on an issue, they feel like they've been snowballed.
Yeah, that doesn't take much up here at all. What were some of your memorable encounters with some of our governors or our politicians?
One of the things that the Alaska Center for the Environment did for many years was have Wednesday sack lunches. And it was in a small room, and sometime there would be five people and sometime there would be 25 people. And you never knew who was going to walk in the door, because these were issues that people had raised as something they wanted to talk about, whether it was parks or wildlife or something was happening in their backyard. But you never knew who all was going to show up. And occasionally it would be Jay Hammond then walk in the door, or the Commissioner of Natural Resources or the Commissioner of Environmental Protection. You never knew who was going to walk in the door, and the information that was exchanged always was important to whoever was there, and oftentimes had an effect in terms of an outcome of a situation.
Yeah. Were those cordial, or did it become controversial?
Generally, it was very cordial. Problem solving and the idea of what people could do to make a difference and who they needed to talk to. One of the other things that was fascinating was that at that time, Channel 2 was the only one that really had a video camera that they would take out into the community, and Scott Foster, who was mainly the person who handled the video, would often show up at one of the Wednesday sack lunches, and so at the evening news, oftentimes there was a blurb that happened occurred from the Wednesday sack lunch. And so that would became a notification on the news that something had happened about a particular issue and some of the discussion that had occurred.
Yeah, that so you knew, I'm sure, governors and whether it was Hammond or Knowles or Cooper or
right.
go through the whole list of
yep.
them, Murkowski. Were they Hickel? I'm sure you have some more Hickel stories and Atwood stories. Bob Atwood wasn't a governor, but he was published at Anchorage Times. So any memories from those encounters?
Well, certainly one time my husband came home from a field trip that he was on with the Wildland Scenic Rivers and walked into the house, and here was a group of people in our living room, including Jay Hammond, who was sitting on the fireplace hearth talking about issues in the state. So you never knew who was going to show up at any one of these meetings. It could be Joe Blow, or it could be a decision maker, and it was great fun to have those opportunities.
Yeah. And at the same time, also, you're raising a family, right?
Absolutely. We have three daughters who went to through high school here, and two are still in the state, and one is in Arizona.
And did they join you on your outdoor adventures?
They did a lot of canoeing with us, primarily when we were in other parts of the country. But as far as being involved in the organizations that I've been involved in. No, they do their own thing.
Yeah, good for them. They've learned how to think independently.
Yes,
sounds
yes,
like
very much so.
Yeah, that's great. When talk about changes concerned, so we're sort of left off in the 80s. I think I first met you in the late 80s, probably right before, during the oil spill.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very a huge event for many of us. So tell us about your involvement and how that affected you.
Well, certainly the oil spill was a life-changing experience, I think, for most Alaskans. We had felt that things would move along smoothly and without, I mean, obviously the earthquake in 64 had made a tremendous impact upon people, and the flood in Fairbanks was followed that up. And I think people were getting settled down, thinking that with the pipeline and the oil flowing, et cetera, that life was good and would not be interrupted. And then the oil, Valdez, Exxon Valdez ran aground, and the change was overnight in terms of how people felt about what was happening to our environment. And some of the efforts to clean up the spill were probably did more damage than the spill itself did ultimately. And there are still sections of Prince William Sound, if you know where to go, that you'll find oil underneath the gravel.
Yeah. And I know you and your husband have a boat and spend a lot of time out there.
Right.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a special place. And so that probably really hurt you and affected you emotionally, too, a little bit, to have a place like that despoiled.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Prince William Sound is probably one of the more special places that are around. And the effect of the oil spill and the effect of the change of under the climate change is really affecting Prince William Sound. We've done a lot of fishing over the years, and the ability to get halibut and even salmon has really diminished considerably over the years. So it's really having an effect, and that was not from the oil spill. That's from, I think, the climate change.
Well, I also think, and we'll talk about climate change in a bit, but I also think there's these, you and I have been out in the sand a lot over the years, and we get used to what it's like. Like we have this image of what it was in the 80s.
Right.
And now people think, oh, they go out there and they think, oh, it's still an amazing, special place, but it has changed.
It has changed enormously.
Right. Yeah, and we forget that baseline. And we don't even know what the baseline
right.
is,
yes.
really. We don't know what it was pre-contact.
You know? And baseline studies are so important, and so few of them have been done in Alaska.
Yeah. So that 1980 oil spill, another thing I think that is a lesson from there that maybe you can reflect on a little bit is sort of the secondary effects of event like that, where a lot of money came in. Exxon, for better or worse, spent a lot of money on trying mm-hmm. to clean things up and make things right. And that money then went to things like helping build the Whittier Road. And
right.
How do you feel about that? How do you feel about access? And because it makes life easier for us, but also has its own effects on the environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the road that they hope ultimately will go to Shotgun Cove is incredible to me, and it. I think it's a waste of money. And the other thing that's going to be interesting is the new terminal that they're planning on building there in the Passage Canal. Huge development that is being proposed, and I guess going forward.
Yeah, for listeners who aren't familiar, that's the a new cruise ship dock, right, which would bring bigger and more ships into Prince William Sound and Passage Canal. And there is an interesting group that's working on a best management practices plan, something like that, for the Whittier and for the Sound. And so there at least some dialogue going on that, of how to maybe help manage some of those effects of those big ships coming and going.
It's like the Sitka. Then when the ships come in, everything, no matter what time they come in, everything opens up, but thousands of people come ashore, and those kind of impacts are significant.
Yeah, it's a tough one because people also make a livelihood off of
it.
Absolutely. And we're sharing our state with people who might not have seen it,
right.
So it's a tough. But those ships are huge. I mean,
they're huge,
really, lots of people and lots of human waste of
and
various
a lot
sorts.
Of pollution, and, right,
yeah,
absolutely.
So it's a tough thing to do right. So other organizations you've been on that I would like to get to: Alaska Conservation Voters. Tell us about that one.
Alaska Conservation Voters was the beginning of getting the conservation feet into the election process. And Kay Brown was the original executive director of that organization. And out of that has ultimately come, I think, the Alaska Center's role in election process in the it's a 501c4. It's still a nonprofit, but it is has the ability to be involved in electoral politics. It's a very important role for environmental and conservation movement to be in, because obviously a lot of decisions are made in the political arena. And unless there's a voice that has an effect in the electoral process, you don't necessarily get people who care about the environment and conservation in office. And it's very important to have that voice in the political process.
Yeah, I think that's... I think we all sometimes get a little cynical about politics and that, but it is where our democracy works.
Absolutely.
And it's really important for everybody to be involved. And there's another part of our system that maybe is necessary, that just because we're at, is the legal side.
Yes.
So then we have the Trustees for Alaska.
Trustees for Alaska was formed 50 years ago. We were getting ready to celebrate our 50th anniversary. The Trustees was formed again at the time when the foundation was formed, and the movement all across the state was gaining forces. And Trustees for Alaska was formed as a legal arm for other organizations to come together and take legal action. The organization does not on its own form or take legal action, but they act in behalf of other entities. The Gwich'in folks have been involved with Trustees, as have a number of other organizations in the state, both environmental organization, local organizations, and tribal organizations, villages primarily.
Yeah, it's unfortunate but necessary then, I think. Then we also, I think you've been a very inspiration for a lot of women, young women, and of all sorts. And talk about that a bit. How has that manifested itself? And yeah,
the organization, which unfortunately no longer exists, it was the Alaska Women's Environmental Network, and we had a number of actual conferences in which we had people, women from all over the state, get together and provide a forum to express concerns and share ideas. One of the forums we were talking about communications, and some of the agency women were obviously had a lot of angst in terms of how communication within their organizations, their governmental body, was dealing with them. That the communications with women was different than with men. Oftentimes, one of the things that we've all experienced, I think, is you have an idea, you're sitting around a table with a mixed group of people, women and men. A woman puts an idea out and it sort of falls on the table and nothing happens. And a man can say the same thing and suddenly it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. And I think most of us have experienced that at one time or another. And so women, we had an opportunity in the network to sit down and talk with women and saying, okay, this is how I handle the situation, or this is what works for me. You might try that. And so it was a network of women that had opportunities in the environmental movement, either in agencies or in environmental organizations, to share ideas and support each other in terms of how we handled sometimes difficult situations.
You listen to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torduck. I'm talking to Ped Tileston, who's been involved with a ton of different issues, conservation issues, and the permanent fund. There's all kinds of things that you've been involved with, Ped. Back to the women, and is there a difference, as you talked about, you know, how people react to ideas between men and women? But what has changed in, let's say, the last 10 years? Do women have stronger voices, and whether it's that?
Oh, there's certainly a lot more women in leadership roles than there used to be. I mean, when I first got started in the movement, women did a lot of secretarial work, a lot of stuffing of envelopes, licking of stamps, getting things out the door, and a lot of the movement was male oriented. That obviously has changed over the years. So women have as important a role now as men, and so it's that part of it has changed significantly.
Yeah, I've always been impressed with the Alaska Center for the Environment, now Alaska Center, that when I first got involved, Steph Kessler was executive director, mm-hmm. a friend of mine, mm-hmm. and then Sue Libinson became executive director. We've had some strong women leadership there.
Yes.
Yep. And that's been wonderful to see. What other changes have you seen in the conservation movement in the last, let's say, getting into the 90s and the O's, the last 20 years? Yeah.
Probably the major change over the years from the time that the environmental movement started, the role of the volunteer was very strong in the early days, and in fact was the major support unit of most of the organizations, even nationally. I think in the 70s, the National Sierra Club, I believe, had something like 15 staff people. That obviously changed very rapidly after the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act passed, with a lot of money attached to it and the regulations, and volunteers said, I'm not interested in reviewing regulations, so somebody else can handle that, and it went over to staff. So over the years, the change in the organization structure has moved from environmental support to staff support, to staff action. And one of my soapboxes is that we need to reinstitute volunteer work in all of this activity, because volunteers are so important and can do so much that staff actually can't do, and can support staff in many ways that the staff could use if they really paid attention into how to get volunteers involved in a meaningful way.
Yeah, that's how I got started. I was like, I'm going to go ahead and stuff envelopes at different organizations.
Right.
And then before you know it, that's another thing about the smallness of Alaska. That one day you're stuffing envelopes, and next minute you're on the board,
right,
and then you're the president of the board.
Right. Yeah.
Basically, it happened to me in about 3 years, I felt like. Yeah. Be careful what you wish for. The other thing, talking about changes, I think the pandemic changed things too a little bit in how we operate.
Absolutely.
Can I talk about that?
I think what the pandemic had a lot of negative aspects to it, the fact that people became isolated. And I think a lot of people realized that they had depression problems because of being isolated. But on the other hand, we have found that there are platforms such as Zoom that we can be involved with people that were not in our neighborhood. And I think we are beginning to figure out what the new normal is going to be as we go forward. Agencies now are continuing to use the various platforms like Zoom and Meetup and so on and so forth to make sure that they are still interacting with people not in their specific neighborhoods, but are able to get out into other parts of the state, which I think is really incredibly important.
Yeah, it's like we like our face-to-face meetings. There's a lot of value to that, but there's also value of bringing in different voices from far reaches of the state.
And the difference between being able to see someone on Zoom and a teleconference, I think teleconferences are terrible because people are loath to do something else while they're listening to somebody on a telephone. I think it's a very unappetizing way to communicate. But Zoom, when you're actually looking at somebody or looking at a room with people in it, it's not the same as being there in person, but it certainly is better than a teleconference.
How about a Commonwealth North? That's a very important group.
It is, and Commonwealth North has changed a bit over the years and become a bit more broad in their approach to things. Originally, when Alaska Common Ground was started, Esther Wernicke felt it was important to have another voice beside Commonwealth North. Alaska Common Ground has filled a role that is not in opposition to Commonwealth North, but at least gives another voice to public policy issues.
Let's talk about Alaska Common Ground then. And so what's the premise behind it?
Premise is that public policy, whether people realize it or not, affect them in every role of their life. Public policy is those things which direct how we live and what we do, because it is every issue has a public policy component to it. Public policy is how government reacts to its population, to its people. And if we don't pay attention to what the role of government as it affects us plays, then we're not paying attention to what we need to be paying attention to. Certainly climate change right now is a major issue that people are finally beginning to realize is going to affect us very, very directly and probably very negatively.
Yeah. Let's talk, in our few minutes we have left, let's talk about the future.
Yes.
We talk about climate change, which is obviously the big one. What positive things do you see going forth as a conservationist and some of the challenges?
I think that people care. I think that the most important thing is that we need to better communicate our issues and our opportunities and get people, no matter what their role in our community and no matter what level of economic well-being they're in, we need to make sure that people understand the role of our surroundings, which is our environment, play in our everyday lives. Because if we don't pay attention, I mean, can you imagine living in the cancer belt in, Louisiana, that people are inundated every day by horrible amounts of pollution. And we know that the cancer rate there is enormous. And so if we don't pay attention to our surroundings, they can be very negative. But on the other hand, if we have opportunities to get out and enjoy Kincaid Park without having a bear hunt, as an example, we're the better for it.
Yeah, and Campbell Track and all the open space we enjoy here in Alaska.
We're very fortunate.
And that became so important during the pandemic. I thought that was a really amazing thing, how many people went outside during the pandemic.
It really made a difference in terms of the amount of use of our open spaces, and it was very important.
And people's well-being, too.
Absolutely.
During that event. So I guess we'll leave it with that. I guess my last question, Peg, is for you, is there climate change, but is there going forward in the last 10 years? If I was a young person entering into concern about environmental issues, where would you point them? What would you tell them to how to get started and what to do?
Pay attention. Look around. Pay attention. Talk to people. If there's an organization that, you know, one of the things that's always amazing to me is, particularly as people get older, I'm so bored. I don't have anything to do. I'm going to sit and vegetate. No matter who you are or what you've done in your life, there's always things that need to be done and people that need help. And there are lots of things that people can do that are important and can make a difference.
I like that. Pay attention. This has been Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torduck. I've been here with Ped Tyleston. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ped. It's been a real honor. It's so wonderful to have an opportunity to talk with you.
Thanks. Thanks to my guest, Ped Tyleston. She's been an inspiration to me and many others. And a big thanks to our producer, Eric Bork. This is your host, Paul Torduck, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, get involved, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.